Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello.
Hello and welcome to Plotting Through the Presidents. I'm Howard Dory.
I'm Jess Dory.
And welcome to another deep, irreverent dive into some lesser-known stories of the early presidents and founders and their families. Today, we're going to return to a character that we've covered in a couple of other episodes, Aaron Burr.
Oh, fun.
Specifically, one aspect of Aaron Burr, his undeniable riz.
His riz.
Yes.
Can you define riz for those, you know, who aren't in the generation that understand what that means?
Yeah, of course. Yes.
Okay.
So riz was Oxford's word of the year for 2023. It probably comes from the word charisma, and it usually refers to the kind of charisma and charm or je ne sais quoi that it takes to attract people.
So it was Oxford's word of the year. So it's not like TikTok's word of the year.
No,
it's like an
Oxford.
Actual word.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Sure. Yeah, it's legit now.
Okay.
It's usually sexual. And there is a lot that we could go into about the sexcapades of Aaron Burr, but that's not the kind of riz that we're focusing on here.
Really?
Really.
I mean, the sexcapades sounds kind of interesting.
Yeah, you know, okay. Well, while we're on the subject, there was a hypersexuality that we could dive deep into, and maybe someday we will. In fact, I'm thinking about doing a Patreon-exclusive episode where we read excerpts from a historical novel that was written about Burr in 1860.
Oh, that's cool.
25 years after he died, right on the eve of the Civil War, someone anonymously published a book called The Amorous Intrigues and Adventures of Aaron Burr.
Wow, 25 years after he died?
Yeah. So it was a biography of Burr with all the key events and the descriptions of him. But in between all those facts were detailed descriptions of Aaron Burr having sex with everyone.
Oh my gosh.
It's erotic historical fiction in the guise of a biography, and it's wild.
But are we sure it's historical fiction?
It is
the important operative words there.
These are imagined scenes of him. It's like fan fiction.
So it's like a romance novel with Aaron Burr.
Yeah, but it's
fan fiction romance.
I haven't read a lot of romance novels. I would consider this more this looks more like erotic fiction than like a Harlequin romance.
Okay.
Just guessing.
You haven't read romance novels, yet you seem so aware about the nuanced differences between the types.
You know, I know a little
which
bit
I wouldn't have known.
A lot, you know.
Fair enough.
But I bring that up just to say that Aaron Burr had a reputation for having that kind of riz and using it.
Okay.
Yes. But what we're going to talk about today is a little different.
Oh, so we're not even talking about that.
We're not going to talk about
his
sexual prowess.
Okay.
No.
We did a little bit just there.
We gave you a taste.
Okay. Maybe that'll be another episode.
You know, maybe.
Patrons can let us know whether or not that's something you're interested in.
That could be the whole show.
I mean, I'm kind of interested.
I am too. I've read some of this novel. And
was it entertaining? Woo!
It was, parts of it were entertaining.
Uh-huh.
It's like,
I mean, I did hear some heavy breathing in the kitchen the other day.
You know. What you doing? Just looking at Google Books. Don't worry about it. Research.
I was like, what's going on in there?
No, today's a little different. We're going to dig into two documented incidents, both in the same month, March of 1805,
mm-hmm.
a year after Burr's infamous duel with Hamilton. Two incidents that show the unexplainable, irrefutable power that Aaron Burr had over those in his presence, including John Quincy and Louisa Adams.
Threesome. No, I'm just kidding.
No spoilers. No spoilers.
And we're not talking about sexual riz, you guys. We got to get that out of our head.
Yeah. Get out of the gutter.
Okay. You all had right. me at hello, but I guess we're pivoting. Okay. Pivot. Pivot.
Pivot.
Pivot.
This is a story in two acts. Act one, the killer goodbye. On March 2nd in 1805, Aaron Burr said goodbye to politics forever. He stood in front of the Senate and he started to speak. And what happened next was described as the most extraordinary event some had ever witnessed, taking his audience out of time into a trance-like state. But first, let's back up a bit and set the stage for how Aaron Burr got here.
You put me in a trance-like state just now.
Just 8 months earlier, he was on the dueling grounds where he took Alexander Hamilton's life. So we're going to back up and take you from those dueling grounds to this moment in the Senate.
Okay.
So he was vice president of the United States when he killed Hamilton.
Wow.
And vice president was a pretty big deal then, not because it was this great job, but because the first two vice presidents, the ones that came before Burr, went on to be president.
Right.
It was a great stepping stone, but it wasn't going to be for Burr. Because
and he knew this?
He knew this because Jefferson was running again for president for a second term, but he was not taking Burr with him.
Oh.
Burr would not be his running mate. So Burr's vice presidency was over. He was out of favor with Jefferson, so there was no way he could run for president himself.
So he was done waiting for it.
Yeah, yeah. There was not much left to wait for, except he thought, hey, I'll try to be governor of New York.
Okay.
You know, he lost that election.
Oh, gosh.
So the future for him was already kind of bleak. But then he got in a duel with Hamilton.
Mm-hmm.
After Hamilton was killed, Burr's future became even more bleak because he was indicted for murder in both New Jersey and New York.
Oh, God.
He was a wanted man.
So what you're saying is people who are felons shouldn't be president.
Well, actually, he was indicted, and you'd think that would stop him from doing his job. But so he flees to the South to get far away from New York and New Jersey. They could have probably extradited him, but it's a little bit tricky. Like, can you arrest a vice president for a state crime? And these are still murky questions that we have. But at that point, he lays low. And then in October, he just goes back to work, back to D.C., back to being the vice president.
He walks in whistling like nothing ever happens.
Almost, almost.
And do people accept that?
Well, what are they going to do? They could impeach him, but he's only got like 5 months left.
Mm-hmm.
He's a lame duck. He's going away.
Right. It's almost like taking the lame way out instead of holding him accountable.
Yeah. Yeah, it would have been difficult and time consuming to hold him accountable, and it didn't seem worth it. Plus, they were pretty busy impeaching another guy.
Who were they impeaching?
They were impeaching a Supreme Court justice, Samuel Chase.
Okay.
This guy was a Federalist, and he was very partisan in his judgments. He let his political feelings cloud how he judged, but that's not really grounds for an impeachment. But Jefferson was a Republican, a Democratic Republican. He wanted this guy, Samuel Chase, gone.
Right.
So he urged the House to impeach him. They did. And then the trial went over to the Senate. And as luck would have it, the person who presides over a trial in the Senate for a judge like this is the president of the Senate, who happens to be the vice president of the United States. So Aaron Burr's last few months were very high profile. He was given this very high position of being a judge over this impeachment trial.
When really he should have been impeached.
And suddenly Jefferson, who doesn't like Burr at all, is inviting Burr to dinners. He's being courted because Burr's fellow Democratic Republicans want him to use his power as judge in this impeachment trial to help get Samuel Chase removed from the bench. They think he can help sway
things.
That's
the priority.
That's their priority, yes. But it doesn't work.
Hmm.
Because Aaron Burr rises to the occasion, and he's the most impartial, efficient, effective, judicial judge ever. People on all sides are like, wow, he's doing a great job, or damn, he's doing a great job, depending on what side they were on.
Right. He's going out with a bang, literally.
He is.
And figuratively.
Yes. It's a very heated, politically charged trial. And Burr runs a tight ship. There's unprecedented stuff happening. You can sort of imagine what the atmosphere must have been like.
Mm-hmm.
Ultimately, Samuel Chase is not convicted. He can go back to being a partisan judge.
So Burr failed Jefferson.
Yeah, Burr.
Again.
Again. Yes. So this ordeal, this trial, is finally over. And it's a very tense, emotionally charged time. And that's important to note because Burr chose the day after that trial's verdict was announced to release his riz upon the Senate floor.
Now, if we're not talking about sexual riz, I'm very interested in the riz you're talking about then. So how is he about to release it? I'm just interested.
Oh, you'll see.
Okay, let's hear it.
Yeah, yeah. So Burr says he didn't write anything down, but he'd been thinking about saying something in front of the Senate for a while as his sort of goodbye. In a letter to his daughter, Theodosia, he said that when he stood before the Senate that day, that it was the solemnity, the anxiety, the expectation, and the interest that he saw on the crowd's faces that inspired what he said. So here's what some witnesses said about that speech. Senator Samuel Mitchell of New York, he was never very close to Burr. He wrote about his experience witnessing Burr's speech just hours after it happened. He said Burr spoke with so much tenderness, knowledge, and concern that it wrought upon the sympathy of the senators in a very uncommon manner. Every gentleman was silent. Not a whisper was heard. And he said at the end, when Mr. Burr had concluded, he descended from the chair and in a dignified manner walked to the door, which resounded as he with some force shut it after him. On this, the firmness and resolution of many of the senators gave way, and they burst into tears.
Wow.
There was a solemn and silent weeping for perhaps 5 minutes.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
It's quite a reaction.
Right? He went on to say, for my own part, I never experienced anything of the kind so affecting as this parting scene. And he said that his fellow senator, General Smith, stout and manly as he is, wept as profusely as I did. He laid his head upon his table and did not recover from his emotion for a quarter of an hour or more.
What?
And for myself, though it is more than 3 hours since Burr went away, I have scarcely recovered my habitual calmness.
Well, let's hear this speech.
Several gentlemen came up to me to talk about this extraordinary scene, but I was obliged to turn away and decline all conversation. So, this
very dramatic.
This stout, manly general is crying profusely, mm-hmm. not just eyes watering, but weeping.
It sounds like a lot of people were.
Yes. Hours later, if you try to talk one of these guys,
he can't.
They'd hold up their hand and be like, "I can't.
I'm still recovering.
I just can't.
Yeah.
I just can't." It was the riz.
Kind of mellow, dramatic. It's very dramatic.
It was a very dramatic moment.
I want to hear the speech, Howard.
Well, we don't have the full speech.
What? How could you do this to me?
We've got some pieces that we're going to get to, for sure. But
why are you holding out?
I'm not done telling you how this made people feel.
Okay.
Okay. The day after the speech, one senator was asked how long Burr had been speaking for. And he said that he could form no idea. It might have been an hour, and it might have been a moment. When he came to his senses, he seemed to be awakened from a kind of trance.
It sounds like Burr roofied all of them, is what it sounds like to me.
I don't know. Another senator there in the audience was 37-year-old John Quincy Adams. He backs up the other accounts. He says that some senators were in tears.
Wow.
But he himself in his writing,
I trust him more.
He's not quite as entranced as everyone else. For example, Adams was still plugged into like time and space. He said that Burr's speech lasted about 20 minutes.
Okay.
So he could define
it. He was not yet in the Twilight Zone.
He was conscious, it sounds like. Yes. But Louisa, in her diary, wrote, "Mr. Burr took his leave of the Senate in a most elegant and even pathetic address."
Oh, dear.
Pathetic at that time had a different meaning. It meant moving and passionate.
It's sentimental.
Yeah. It moves you. It's passionate. Yeah. And she goes on to say, "Mr. Burr took his leave of the Senate in a most elegant and even pathetic address," she said, "delivered in the most graceful and touching manner. And Mr. Adams, who had never liked him, came home quite affected by his manner, appearance, and sentiment. So Adams himself might have been trying to play it cool, but it sounds like even he was quite affected. And it sounds like Louisa was too. Burr's speech was so moving that she was feeling the effects of secondhand riz.
Secondhand riz.
Yes. Yes.
Wow.
So I know you're wondering.
That's intense.
It is. It is. So I know you're wondering, what did he say that was so impactful?
I mean, I did ask before.
You did ask before.
And you told me you don't know. You told me you don't know what he said.
I know a little bit. So first, he started off by saying that, you know, he'd planned to stay longer, but he had a sore throat, mm-hmm. which we can identify with at the moment.
Yeah, we're both suffering from that ailment.
Yes. So he's already lowering expectations.
Mm-hmm.
Then he talked about some suggestions for rule changes going forward in the Senate. He talked about how he always tried to conduct himself to the best of his abilities, and he never showed anyone any intentional disrespect. He talked about sort of
except
honor
for Hamilton, who he killed. Not disrespectfully.
No. It was an affair of honor. Yeah.
Nodding. Yeah. Nod and smile.
I think it was more of a like, of the people in this room, I haven't killed any of you.
Oh, okay. Yeah. I respect you guys.
Yeah. But it's really the end of the speech that resonated the most. Piecing together different accounts, because there's no copy from Burr, this is how he ended his speech, talking about the importance of the Senate as the last defense against the enemies of democracy. He said, "This body is growing in importance. This house is a sanctuary, a citadel of law, of order, and of liberty. And it is here in this exalted refuge, here, if anywhere, will wild resistance be made to the storms of political frenzy and the silent arts of corruption. And if the Constitution be destined ever to perish by the sacrilegious bands of the demagogue or usurper, which may God avert, its dying agonies will be witnessed on this floor."
Wow.
Yeah.
Some beautiful personification there.
Powerful stuff.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not roofied, but I'm...
Well, you weren't there.
I wasn't there.
Yeah, the riz doesn't work like
through you. It doesn't work through you.
Yeah. It's not like third...
You can't channel his
riz.
There's
no tertiary riz.
tertiary
yes.
riz.
So this is powerful stuff. Like, mm-hmm. And I want to talk a little bit about what he's saying here.
Okay.
Like, he talks about a demagogue, mm-hmm. which, you know, I
that
really...
That is powerful.
Yes, yes. And as much as I want that to just be the monster from Stranger Things and Dungeons and Dragons...
No, it's not.
It's not at all.
It's not just there.
So the word is thrown around a lot, so much that I think it's almost lost its meaning. So I wanted to look at the actual definition now and then.
Okay.
So a modern dictionary definition of a demagogue is a leader who makes use of popular prejudices and false claims and promises in order to gain power.
Oh, it's so right on.
Yeah.
It's what we're seeing.
In the founder's time, Samuel Johnson's dictionary defined a demagogue as a ringleader of the rabble.
What's a rabble?
Well, he defined rabble as a tumultuous crowd, an assembly of low people.
Oh, wow.
Yes.
Interesting.
Yes.
Did he have a definition of low people?
I didn't go that far.
Because yeah. That would be interesting.
No, no. But he's got friends in low places.
Apparently.
Samuel Johnson's definition of usurper, the last thing I'll define for you, uh-huh. my little homily here, was one who seizes or possesses that to which he has no right.
Wow. That's roofied me more than Burr's speech.
Yeah.
Your definitions.
I mean, that's what people were thinking.
You just
then.
Laid on the riz, babe.
Oh, baby. All right. Okay.
Now I know how to talk dirty to you.
Yes.
This is what you want to hear.
You know, I had you at usurper.
And you had me at riz.
Yes. So
these are very accurate descriptions to a certain someone, but we'll
yeah.
I'm going to let you take it away.
Well, I mean, this is what Aaron Burr was talking about. This is what Hamilton and Madison and Adams and other founders were talking about as the greatest threat to the United States. It's the built-in weakness of a democracy when you leave it up to the people to choose their leaders, and you have to hope that the institutions in place, like the Senate, would be strong enough to withstand even a demagogue.
And this is the ultimate enemy of democracy.
Yes. Yes.
and according to Burr, should be slain on the floor of Congress.
Well, what? No, I mean.
Oh, what? Isn't that what he said?
Democracy. You will see democracy die on the floor of the Senate. That will
I
be
see.
The last
from the, hands
the last
of a
refuge. Mm-hmm. They're the last defense.
Right.
So when if democracy dies, it will be here on the Senate floor.
I see.
Yeah.
Wow. Okay. Now I'm feeling a little rizzed.
Yeah.
I mean, we saw with January 6th and everything that led up to that, it's so clearly comes tumbling down when that type of person is in power.
I mean, looking at that, looking at just those dictionary definitions, it would be very hard not to look at January 6th and see a demagogue trying to ringlead the rabble to help him usurp.
It's all the terms in one. It all came together.
It really is.
Because I think these character traits go hand in hand, obviously.
Yeah.
And so it all came together to overthrow our democracy. And that's what was almost happening. And could happen again.
Yeah. Let us tell you about a podcast we think you're gonna love.
Step into the world of Southern Gothic, a narrative history podcast with immersive sound design and in-depth research that brings history to life and uncovers the truth behind classic tales of the paranormal.
Hosted by our good friend Brandon Schexnider, Southern Gothic digs into the dark history and infamous legends of the American South.
The podcast covers stories like the Greenbrier Ghost, a West Virginia woman who became the first ghost to help convict her killer in court.
And of course, the Bell Witch of Tennessee, who we covered because of her alleged showdown with Andrew Jackson.
And recently they covered the tragic, haunting story of Theodosia Burr, Aaron Burr's daughter, whose mysterious disappearance at sea led to a ton of rumors and a ton of ghost stories.
Now, if y'all are ready to head on out to the swamp and give Southern Gothic a listen, head over to southerngothicmedia.com/follow for links to all of your favorite podcast apps. That's southerngothicmedia.com/follow.
That is, if you dare.
Want to learn how you can make smarter decisions with your money? Well, I've got the podcast for you. I'm Sean Piles, and I host NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast. On our show, we help listeners like you make the most of your finances. I sit down with NerdWallet's team of nerds, personal finance experts in credit cards, banking, investing, and more. We answer your real-world money questions and break down the latest personal finance news. The nerds will give you the clarity you need by cutting through the clutter and misinformation in today's world of personal finance. We don't promote get-rich-quick schemes or hype unrealistic side hustles. Instead, we offer practical knowledge that you can apply in your everyday life. You'll learn about strategies to help you build your wealth, invest wisely, shop for financial products, and plan for major life events. And you'll walk away with the confidence you need to ensure that your money is always working as hard as you are. So turn to the nerds to answer your real-world money questions and get insights that can help you make the smartest financial decisions for your life. Listen to NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast wherever you get your podcasts.
History never says goodbye. It just says, see you later. Edward Galliano was right when he said that. Events keep happening over and over again in some form. And that's the reason I produce the podcast My History Can Beat Up Your Politics. What is it? We take stories of history and apply them to the events of today to help you, perhaps, understand them better. We are also part of Airwave Media Network. I've been doing the program since 2006. That's a long time, and the show has a long name. My History Can Beat Up Your Politics. Find me wherever you get podcasts.
But what Burr was saying, it was a powerful reminder of their power, of the power of the senators.
Mm-hmm.
And it was also something else. He was also shaming many of them who had just cheapened the use of impeachment by using it just because they didn't like how a judge ruled.
Right. Interesting.
It reminds me of the scene in The Sound of Music where the kids put a pine cone on Maria's chair at dinner.
Yeah.
And she sits on it, but she doesn't say anything.
Uh-huh.
Instead, she talks about the great qualities of the kids until they all start crying in shame.
Right.
That was Burr saying to the Senate, you're better than this. Serve mm-hmm. your damn country.
Right.
You know, and I'm not going to pretend that Burr wasn't this incredibly political creature.
And isn't it a little hypocritical? Because shouldn't he be impeached for his actions within the last 8 months?
You know, is that an ad hominem argument saying, like, this person can't have a point because they did this other thing? I don't know.
Not that he can't, but that it's a little bit contradictory to have him be the one delivering it.
Which only goes to show how powerful his Riz was, how charismatic he was, that he was able to effectively deliver that message. Even coming from him, mm-hmm. it got through. He broke through the partisan divide, and he just had these men weeping.
Wow.
Yeah.
Mic drop.
Yeah. If mics weren't invented then, he would have dropped one before he slammed the door shut.
I can see that.
Yes, that was mm-hmm. basically the 18th century mic drop.
The essence, yeah. Slam the door is the mic drop. You've been rizzed.
Yes. As much of an impact as this speech had on the people who heard it in 1805, it had an even bigger impact on one person in 1843.
Hmm. In the fan fiction?
No, this was not
that's
the
right. We're not going
amorous
to that
intrigues of Aaron Burr.
Okay.
This was real life. This was Congressman John White from Kentucky. He was the Speaker of the House.
I don't know if I've heard of him.
Nobody's heard of him.
Okay.
So John White was the Speaker of the House, but his Whig party lost the majority, and he was stepping down from that role. Mm. So he wanted to give a speech to mark the occasion. He reportedly hired a ghostwriter to put something together for him.
Mm-hmm.
And on March 4th, 1843, he delivered those words to the House of Representatives, and it wasn't long before folks realized that those weren't his words. They were Aaron Burr's.
What? The ghostwriter copied Aaron Burr?
Yes, yes, reportedly.
That's not okay.
No, it's not. Newspapers called it an extraordinary coincidence. Several carried the story that said, "The reader will find below, placed side by side, two speeches. One delivered in the U.S. Senate by Aaron Burr in 1805, and the other by the late Whig Speaker of the House of Representatives in Congress, delivered last March, and which, with a trifling arrangement of words, will be found the same."
Oh my gosh. This ghostwriter should be fired.
Yeah,
you can't just plagiarize other people's speeches.
No, you can't.
As a writer.
No, you can't. I mean,
it's like not doing your job at all.
No, I mean,
fail.
Yeah. I agree. Maybe it was just blamed on a ghostwriter. Maybe John White did it himself.
Wow.
I don't know for sure, but I know that looking at these two speeches, it was undeniably plagiarism.
I feel like it's such an idiotic move for either of them.
It is, because it was a pretty famous speech.
Right.
Yeah.
Can't copy someone else's riz.
No. No, because there are consequences.
Okay, what are the consequences?
People said that John White could never live down the shame of that moment.
Mm.
2 years later, he died by suicide with a pistol.
Oh my God. Because of that?
Later, that's how the story was told. It was said to be because of his shame for having inadvertently plagiarized this famous speech. One report suspected that it was due to depression over financial embarrassments. I mean, which could have been linked to that shame. I don't know. It's really hard to say.
It sounds a little simplistic, but
especially since there was a 2-year difference. It's not like the next day.
Right.
So I can't.
But I mean, it sounds like it affected his life, though.
Yeah. Yeah. And I can't say if that speech is really what led to his death, but I can say that Burr's words had an impact beyond his time.
Wow.
Yes. Now I want to take you back to March 1804, mm-hmm. right after Burr has given his speech. He's left the Senate. He's ready to leave D.C., but he's still got some riz to spread. And John Quincy and Louisa Adams are about to be the direct recipients.
Oh, no.
That brings us to Act Two, a much shorter act. Strangers on a Ship. Now, this instance might not be as dramatic as a bunch of grown men, like, crying and shaking at their desks.
Mm-hmm.
But for anyone who's ever traveled, especially with children, I think it's going to resonate.
Okay. It's going to riz and resonate.
Yes, the riz will resonate. Yes.
The yeah. riz will resonate. The riz has risen.
Yeah, the riz has risen. Wow.
You're welcome. You're welcome.
excuse me a minute. I have to go write the next new hit Christian rock single. I will be back in a minute.
You're welcome. You're welcome.
So this story came to my attention from an article by Gwen Fries on the blog The Beehive from the Massachusetts Historical Society. I'm going to link to it in the show notes on plodpod.com. It's a great blog. So John Quincy Adams, Louisa Adams, their two young sons, George, who's almost five, and John, who's not even two, and Louisa's sister, Eliza, they're all on their way to Philadelphia, and they boarded a ship first to Baltimore along the way. Who else is on board?
Aaron Burr.
Louisa's never met him before.
Okay.
But she loathes him.
But she heard his speech.
She heard John Quincy Adams talk about his speech.
Oh, got it. Okay.
But she still...
She wasn't there. Yeah.
She wasn't there. And when she wrote about that speech and she said how affected he was, she still had... And she may have been hit by some secondhand riz.
Right.
But she was still very judgmental of him.
Okay.
She said that she hated this man for his duel.
Mm-hmm.
And she was wary that the way that he gave that speech and affected people, she said that his refinement and polished decorum were really disguising and whitewashing his sins, which morality must condemn.
Yeah, I feel that way.
So
I get where she's coming from.
Yeah.
That's what I was saying.
Yeah, okay.
I mean, not as eloquently. But that's what I was saying. It's like, oh, it's coming from him, but didn't he have a few sins that he needed to be held accountable for?
Yeah.
Sins, lack of a better word, you know, but.
Yes, yes. And at this point, John Quincy Adams was not a fan either. Even though he witnessed his speech, he wrote, "I had kept him at arm's length the whole session of Congress. I'd felt it a cruel degradation to the body itself to have for a president at such a time and on such an occasion, a man under a legal accusation of murder. And
right.
I could not forgive him for taking the seat."
That's what I'm talking about.
Yes.
I'm on their page. I get it. I get where they're coming from.
They had some strong feelings about it.
Some confusing feelings.
So they were both predisposed to hating Burr.
Okay.
But that most affecting speech was still on John Quincy Adams' mind.
And his heart.
Yes. But then Louisa... First, I'll let you hear the story from her. She started to feel that riz firsthand.
Wow.
Okay.
No longer secondary.
No. Direct riz.
Direct riz.
To the face. She wrote, "The children were both quite unwell, and of course very troublesome. It was the first time that I had the entire charge of them, and my anxiety was proportioned to my want of health and strength." So she's not feeling
Mother's
great.
Words.
Yeah. She's not feeling great herself. She's weak. Mm-hmm. She's anxious. The kids are sick. And the kids are really sick.
Like, are they seasick?
So the kids, they were sick. When they finally got to Philadelphia, Dr. Benjamin Rush diagnosed them.
Bled them out.
He said, "The problem is your boys, they got too much blood. We're going to have to take some blood out the boys." No, he said one had whooping cough and one had chicken pox.
Oh, babies.
Yeah. So, yeah, that's Louisa.
They were in a bad way. Poor Louisa.
They were in a bad way. And she said, I thought it was weird that she said she had the entire charge of them because she's got John Quincy there. She's got her sister. So I reached out to Gwen Fries, the editor of the John Adams papers at the Massachusetts Historical Society, who wrote about that. And I'm like, what does she mean here? She said that Louisa was probably used to traveling with several sisters, with servants, and her sister wanted to be out socializing. So when they're on the ship, Eliza's, you know, talking to other people. And it's not that John Quincy was refusing to help with the kids or anything. It's that whenever...
It sounds like it.
Whenever they traveled, people wanted to talk to him. He was forced to socialize whether he wanted to or not.
Okay.
So with her husband and sister distracted... And two really sick kids, she felt
overwhelmed.
All alone. Yes.
Overwhelming. Yes.
And the voyage itself.
Sounds like she was ill too.
Yeah. She was often ill.
Oh.
And this was not an exception. And the voyage itself is so rough and choppy that at one point she was thrown from her top bunk onto the floor.
Oh my gosh.
This was the trip from hell.
Sounds like it.
Enter Burr. Louisa wrote, "When I returned into the cabin, Mr. Burr, the vice president, was already there, and I was formally introduced to him. He was a small man, quite handsome, and his manners were strikingly prepossessing. And in spite of myself, I was pleased with him. He appeared to fascinate everyone in the boat, down to the lowest sailor, and knew everybody's history by the time we left."
Wow. I mean, he's in a place of power for a reason, I guess.
Yeah, for sure. "He was politely attentive to me, devoted to my sister. At table, he assisted me to help the children with so much ease and good nature, I was perfectly confounded.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's very nice of him.
Yeah, he's stepping in when apparently no one else is. You know, she's sick, she's weak, she's got this opening, and he's just pouring riz into it.
He's pouring riz into her vulnerability.
Yes, yes. Then she wrote, at about 12 at night, we landed. And it was diverting to see Mr. Burr with my youngest child in his arms,
aww,
a bundle in his hand, and leaning on his other arm to walk from the wharf while my sister, Mr. Adams, and George followed us. So he's got one of the kids in his arms. He's got a bundle of stuff. And he gives his arm to Louisa to help her off the boat.
Oh, my goodness.
Yes. And she says, yet it was all done with so little parade and with such entire good breeding that it made you forget that he was doing anything out of the way. He talked and laughed all the way, and we were quite intimate by the time we got to Philadelphia, where he called to see us. And this was the first and last occasion on which I ever saw this celebrated man.
Wow.
She went from loathing to quite intimate.
Yeah.
That is the power of Aaron Burr's riz.
Yeah. And such a complicated man.
Yeah.
He had a lot of feelings inside that little man. But also, like, just to step up and be so helpful in a time of need just shows you his empathy. And
yeah. And I mean, you have to wonder, is Burr just this calculated sociopath?
I mean, that was my question.
To get into people's diaries for posterity. Because right. There wasn't much to be gained from this.
Right.
Or was he kind of a chivalrous, like, gentleman, mm-hmm, who really did have strong feelings about honor? Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's what can get you into a duel. And did he want to do the right thing a lot of the time?
Mm-hmm.
Also combined with crazy ambition and conniving and scheming and stuff.
Right. I think you've really nailed him.
I nailed the question.
I mean, no, you nailed the question, but I don't think getting into everyone's diaries, especially Louisa's, was his top priority.
Right.
But I think his riz and his charisma and his chivalry at times probably assisted him in gaining the power he has.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know.
So we get the same sort of situation from John Quincy's point of view as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's good, because where the fuck was he?
He was walking behind them.
Well, where was he?
I don't know.
Wasn't he carrying his children?
You know, he's got a lot of briefcases.
This is your favorite president. Why isn't he carrying a bundle in his child?
Look, if Burr comes along with all his riz, well, what's John Quincy supposed to do? Hey,
this is my family and I'll pick him up.
There's other kids. I think John
Quincy.
How many
kids did they have?
There were two boys with them. And I think that John Quincy had the other boy.
Okay.
Yeah.
So he was carrying one child as well.
Probably.
So he has some unmentioned riz.
I mean, duty.
Obligation.
Yeah.
So, you're like, I'm feeling that right now.
Writing about their encounter with Burr, John Quincy Adams started off comparing him to the devil.
Wow, that's harsh.
Well, he was talking about his reputation beforehand.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, whether the original seducer of mankind has embodied himself in the person of the little ex-vice, I am not competent to pronounce. This I will say.
Just like you said, I'm not sure what his actual intentions were.
Right. And he's writing to his brother here. He says, this I will say, that I defy man, woman, or child so to withstand the powers of his fascination. And to part from him after such a transitory association without feelings of goodwill towards him.
Mm.
Aaron Burr was the definition of disarming.
Mm-hmm.
John Quincy said that Burr had turned out to be the most amiable, attentive, and complacent of traveling companions, and that he found his feelings of resentment ready to turn to respect.
Yeah.
He said Burr was more than civil to me and my family, and he wrote, I could not help feeling for him in return more kindness than I was willing to acknowledge to myself. Infinitely more than I suffered myself to show him. So John Quincy here had to hold himself back from being too kind to Burr.
Mm-hmm.
They were powerless to resist the
his
charisma,
riz.
Yes, of Aaron Burr.
Cannot resist the riz.
Now, I have to wonder if their prejudice toward him like played some kind of role, like in how low their expectations were.
Mm-hmm.
It's almost like if you've built him up to be the devil, when he's not what you expect, those strong feelings that you had get mixed up and they become just as strong the other way, maybe.
I mean, it sounds like they were feeling very vulnerable and in need and had two sick kids. Or maybe they were just more surprised by the fact that they had warm feelings.
Maybe.
I think that probably heightens their surprise.
Yeah. And I'm wondering if it's also like some kind of Stockholm syndrome where you go like, oh, you know, he wasn't that bad. You know, in fact, I joined his cult. You should try it.
I can't imagine leaving a ship after days of being thrown out of your bed and probably vomit everywhere. I just can't imagine leaving a ship feeling like sane at all.
No,
so
no.
It's just, they, you know, all the feelings and all the mental, you know, wear and tear from a journey like that, I can imagine leaves for, you know, some interesting diary entries.
And I think, yeah, the fact that they wrote about it, it's notable because of the opinions they had before. If it was just some random stranger that was super helpful, that wouldn't have made...
There's definitely a dichotomy.
Yeah. I know they say, like, never meet your heroes, but maybe they should also say, like, never meet your enemies, because if they're good, they can take those strong feelings and your preconceived notions and turn them, you know, into admiration or adoration or lust. That's how charming and disarming Burr was.
Mm-hmm.
Even after he'd been indicted for murder, he was rizzing his enemies into loving him.
Mm-hmm.
And it makes me think that maybe he could have turned it all around for himself.
Like, I mean, he kind of did.
You know.
With that speech.
That was a high point, I would say. And I think that had he continued on that path, he could possibly have gone on to be president someday.
Mm-hmm.
But instead, he sought out an opportunity for wealth and power. And it led to his being accused of treason in a trial where Thomas Jefferson did everything he could to make sure that Aaron Burr would be found guilty and sentenced to death.
Wow. And we have an episode on that, don't we?
We don't.
Oh my gosh.
No. The question is, would he have enough riz to save his own life? That's a story for another day.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Not anytime soon.
Okay.
So that's the story of the undeniable riz of Aaron Burr.
Wow. He sounds like a great travel companion.
Yeah.
And a good speaker.
Yes.
And he didn't seem all that well, though. He had some issues.
He did have some issues.
And I think to get to where you, if you have some issues, to get to where you are, you also have to have some riz, or else you don't get to a place of power at all.
Yeah. His riz helped his rise.
Yes. There you go.
Next up, we've got the brand new track, He Is Risen, by JC Riz. If you want to hear more about Aaron Burr, we've got a couple episodes from the beginning of season 4 about Burr's team up with Hamilton to defend an accused murderer, and then about the most scheming I think Burr ever did to form the Manhattan Company. Really love that episode.
Yeah, that was a fantastic episode and shows you the opposite side of his riz.
Yes.
His, the riz on one side and then this scheming, conniving, dishonest person on the other.
You know, I think
there's
an overlap.
It's just so interesting. So interesting that it's just one person.
Yes. In our next episode, we are going to hear from a man who started a journey when he was just a kid to visit the gravesite of every U.S. president and vice president.
This isn't you?
No. No.
Sounds like something you would do.
I wouldn't have had the perseverance to stick with something like this. Historian and author Kurt Dion joins us to talk about his book, Presidential Grave Hunter.
Oh.
One kid's quest to visit the tombs of every president and vice president.
Wow. And as a kid, that's quite a feat as a child.
Yes.
You'd have to have some supportive adults around you.
Yes, it really, I mean, it is a story about that support and family and making a kid's
dreams come true.
Esoteric dreams come true, yes. So visit plodpod.com for more info. Consider joining our Patreon family to support our efforts and access some cool bonus material. And you can be like some of our newer patrons, John, Carolyn, Lucas, and Marianne. Thank you so much for your support. Welcome.
Welcome.
This has been an Airwave Media podcast. Thank you for plotting along with us.
Thanks for plotting. Pivot. Pivot.
Pivot.
Pivot. You've been rezzed.